This is Bishop Phoebe Rofe of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis on 91.7 FM WYXR here in Memphis. Each week, we have an opportunity to talk with a local or national community leader to learn more about their work and the role of faith in their life. And we always begin the show with a saint of the day. And I was ordained and consecrated as bishop on May the 4th. So I celebrated my second anniversary as a bishop earlier this week. May the 4th is the feast day for Monica, the mother of St. Augustine of Hippo. And so, of course, she holds a special place in my heart because her feast day was such a joyous event for me. Monica's life story is outlined in the spiritual autobiography of her son called The Confessions of St. Augustine. So she was born in North Africa in the year 331. Monica was raised in a Christian family, but interestingly enough, her parents selected a pagan husband for her. Now, it wasn't always easy, but after years of prayer and her wonderful example, Monica's husband converted to Christianity a year before his death. And her oldest child was Augustine. And he, in the early years of his life, really wasn't living what you could consider to be a Christian life. And that didn't sit very well with his mother. And for a while, she kind of kicked him out of the house and didn't let him stay there. But one night, she had a vision, I guess you could call it a dream, that one day he would return to the faith. And so from that time on, she continuously prayed and fasted that her son Augustine would dedicate his life to God. So when he turned 29, Augustine decided to go to Rome to teach, and Monica went with him. And while he was there, he came under the influence of Bishop Ambrose, who was also Monica's spiritual director. So on Easter, in the year 387, Bishop Ambrose baptized Augustine and several of his friends. And soon after that, the family returned or planned to return to Africa. And while they were waiting for the ship to arrive in Rome, Monica got sick. She realized just how sick she was and told her sons that they were going to end up burying her there in Italy. Now, her younger son was really worried that his mother would not be buried in Africa. But Monica said, and this was included in her son Augustine's book, "Nothing is far from God, and I need have no fear that he will not know where to find me when he comes to raise me to life at the end of the world." So she did die in Italy, and she's buried there to this day. So Monica's life is really a reminder that all of us came to faith by invitation. If you are a member of any faith community, somebody had to tell you about God and encourage you to consider joining the church or the synagogue or the mosque or the temple. So if your relationship with God has been a positive force in your life, consider following in the example of Monica. Share your faith journey with someone else and serve as an encouragement for them.
Oh, mountains of Mecca, what can you say of the day that Abraham passed? passed your way, and he was instructed by God to build a house of peace where people will pray, and they will come on every lean camel and out of every ravine for the purpose of praising Allah, to glorify Allah. O mountains of Mecca, what can you tell of the day that stones from the sky fell, destroying an army determined to break the house of Allah that Abraham built? O mountains of Mecca, how was the dawn on the day that my prophet Muhammad was born? How did it feel knowing he was to be the last and most beloved of all? Rasul of Allah, Nabi of Allah. O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord to all of mankind, this was his call: La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. That the beloved returned to his Lord, and up till the last breath escaped from his lips, he prayed that his Ummah would find success. O mountains of Mecca, how will it feel when the earth shall quake and tremble with fear, and we shall be gathered together to stand in the court of Allah with our deeds at hand? Oh, how we pray that on that day we'll be with those to whom Allah will say, peace be with you, I am pleased with you. O mountains of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that he's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah, Muhammad is his messenger. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah, Muhammad is his messenger. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad Rasulullah. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad Nabi Allah. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad Rasulillah. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad Rasul of Allah.
Thanks again for joining Faithfully Memphis, and today I'm really pleased to invite our special guest, Anwar Arafat, who is the Community Outreach Director of the Memphis Islamic Center. And I learned, Anwar, from your bio that you have served as an imam in Salt Lake City, Nashville, and here in Memphis, and that you have an undergraduate degree in film from the University of Utah. And you're actually working on a master's degree in Islamic education from the Islamic Seminary of America. And I had the opportunity to get to know Anwar through an interfaith group of clergy convened by the Reverend Dr. Scott Morris at Church Health to help the faith community develop a coordinated strategy to deal with COVID-19. So Anwar, welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
So can you tell us a little bit about your background? Where did you grow up?
Yeah. So, I mean, you kind of said it. I grew up in Utah. I was born there. We lived there for a while. And then halfway through elementary, our family moved to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so I lived there for a while. I actually lived in Gaza. If you've heard of it before.
No, I'm sorry. I have.
It's all over. Yeah.
I have.
I mean, it's all over the news usually. So we lived there for about 10 years and then we came back stateside and, you know, I went to college. And then I got another degree in Islamic studies, you know, an undergrad. And then now I'm working on my master's. So, yeah.
Excellent. So Christians, Jews, and Muslims, we all share a common ancestor, and that is Abraham. And we're also, I think all three faith traditions are people of the book, because of course, our Jewish brothers and sisters have the Torah, and Christians have the Bible, and Muslims have the Quran. So I have learned a little bit about Islam over the years from different Muslim friends. And I know a little bit about the five pillars of Islam. And part of the reason that we're having this conversation now is because fasting is one of the five pillars, and you are currently in the season of Ramadan. But I would imagine that there are a lot of folks listening today to this show who may not be familiar at all with anything that has to do with the beliefs of Muslims. So could you maybe give us a sense of what is central or essential about Islam for you personally?
Yeah. No, it's a great question. You know, like you said, we are in the middle of Ramadan, which means that for Muslims, for 30 days, we don't eat during the day. So right at sunset, we have a meal, and we can eat and drink all night long up until about an hour before sunrise. And then that's it. We stop and we fast for about 15 or 16 hours. It is a form of intermittent fasting, but we do it for 30 straight days. So it can get a little intense. Right now, today we are on day 21 of the month. So I haven't eaten or drinking in the daytime for 21 days.
Wow.
You know, our schedules flip. Yeah. So far. And we still have about 9 days left. So, you know, we're in the home stretch right now. And, you know, Ramadan for us, it's one of the five pillars of Islam. And when we say pillars, we mean these are the main ideas behind what it is to be a Muslim. Right. So fasting Ramadan is pillar number four. You know, pillar number one is the belief in God as one God, has no partners, etc. And that Muhammad is the messenger of God, that he's in a lineage of other prophets and messengers. Like you said, we have a common ancestor. In fact, I believe we share almost all of the prophets across, you know, the three different faiths, you know, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And that, you know, as Muslims, we just believe that they culminated with Muhammad. We just add one more or two more, I guess, you know, depending on your perspective. But that's pretty much, you know what I mean, the first pillar. You know, it means that we live a life that's sincere to God, dedicated to God, and we live it according to the teachings that Prophet Muhammad came with, peace be upon him and all the prophets. Mm-hmm. So that's pillar number one. Pillar number two is the five daily ritualistic prayers that we do. You know, pillar number three is the, now, of course, within those prayers, there's a lot of voluntary extra prayers that a person can do throughout the day. You know what I mean? It's not just five, but the five main ones are like the required, right? So, and then pillar number three is the paying of charity, which is paid on a person's, you know, wealth. It's not on income. So it's on, you know, if you have savings, investments, et cetera, you pay on that. You don't pay on your income. And it's meant to be taken from the wealthy. So you have to be above a threshold to qualify as a wealthy person. And it's given to the poor. It's not used to like build buildings or to do anything like this. So we have to we have to hand it directly to the poor. That's number three. Number four is the fasting of Ramadan, like we said. And then number five is the pilgrimage once in a person's lifetime to Mecca. All of these are according to a person's ability. So, for example, like right now in the month of fasting, if I'm sick or if I'm traveling, in the Quran, it says that the person should not fast. And in fact, if a person is sick and they're at a point where fasting will harm them, they're actually sinful for fasting. Because the purpose of fasting, you know, is not to induce difficulty or harm. It's to develop God consciousness and awareness, self-discipline, and a lot of other things. So, yeah.
So that's is definitely something that all three faith traditions share. Because there's also fasting as a spiritual discipline in Christianity and in Judaism. So I've been told that Islam, the word, can mean peace and also submission to God. So is that a correct understanding of what the word itself means?
Yeah, so Islam is submission, right? But because Arabic is a Semitic language, and so it shares common roots with almost all Semitic languages, in that the sense that they're all root-based languages as well. So from its root is that three-letter root, which is, you know, salam. So it's the S-L-M. And from that we get salam, which means peace, which is also used as the greeting. We get istislam, which is surrender. We get salama, which is, you know, healthiness, being healthy. You get a lot of different meanings. And the rule is, generally speaking, linguistically, that if a word shares a common root, they also have common meanings. And so, but the main meaning of Islam is submission. And obviously it means to submit to God, right? In the sense that, you know, we obey him fully, we accept him fully. We accept his decrees fully. You know, whatever happens to us in our lives, sometimes we complain against, you know, our fate or destiny, when in reality we're complaining against God, right? You know this. And so submission is a sense of like acceptance, and not only acceptance, but taking it to a higher level is that we're actually pleased with it. We're okay with it. And we see that whatever happens to us is actually good for us ultimately. And any person who's fair that looks back on their life, we'll actually realize that this is truly the case, that whatever happens, whatever happened to me that in the moment I might have been upset with or not have, you know, been happy with, but I wouldn't be the person that I am today if it weren't for that thing. And so you learn to fully submit, you know, as well through experience. So, yeah.
So I think that as a Christian, we certainly believe that God has a plan for our life. And God also gave us free will. So sometimes the messes that we find ourselves in, maybe I shouldn't project that I find myself in over time. I might want to blame God, but sometimes I have to actually be honest and say, well, that was because Phoebe made certain choices. So I'm curious, you know, what is the notion of free will within Islam?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have a balanced approach between the two extremes, right? And what's interesting is that historically, there were some Muslim groups who went to one extreme over the other, right? But they were very minorities, and this is why, you know, like 90% of Muslims today are within that balanced approach that you know what I mean, we have. On one extreme, you know, they say that there's no predestination, there's no plan. God doesn't know that. God couldn't know the future, etc. Obviously, that's limiting to God. We don't believe that that's befitting to who God is, and etc. And they believe that there's just complete free will, right? We're writing our own destiny as we go on. On the other extreme, they believe that, well, since God is so great and supreme, he did write everything, but we're forced into it. We're almost like robots or zombies. We're just following a predestined, we have no free will. Where in fact, it's actually somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And it can get confusing because we don't have the perspective that God has. God has that, you know, infinite, absolute knowledge over everything, and an absolute will over everything. But he did give us free agency. And I like to use that word free agency because it's not absolute free will where we can just do whatever we want. We have limitations. Mm-hmm. We have, you know what I mean? But we are presented regularly, like you said, with choices in our lives, and we make those. God has already written them down through his infinite knowledge, right? We believe in the Quran, there's a verse that says that God wrote down everything that's going to take place in exact detail 50,000 years before he created the heavens and the earth, right? Before we were even made. Mm-hmm. And then the next verse, he says, this is in order for you to know that whatever missed you was not going to happen to you, and that you should not feel sorrow over that which you missed. So if there's a missed opportunity or something that I feel regret over, that's it. It's a done deal. And it allows the believer to kind of move on, move forward, and not dwell on the past too much, you know, which leads to depression, sadness. Mm-hmm. And then it also says, and for you to not feel overjoyous over that which comes your way. That we know that a lot of times we feel a sense of entitlement that whatever I get or whatever I have, it's because I fully deserve it. Or, yeah, I'm owed this. When in reality, God is saying, you're owed nothing. Everything that we have, everything that we are is through his bounty, right? It's through his blessing, his mercy, that he even gave us life and sustains us and gives us, you know what I mean, everything that we have and everything that makes up who we are. I hope that clarifies it a little bit. We can get into more detail, but yeah, go ahead.
No, I do. Yeah, I do. And I think to moderate that the lows aren't quite so low and the highs aren't quite so high is probably a great way to approach life, regardless of your faith tradition.
Yeah.
But you mentioned in your answer about 90% of Muslims probably fall in that sort of balanced range. And in my experience, Anwar, all of the faith traditions have individuals who are extremists, for lack of a better word. And yet I sense that the extremist voices within Islam probably get more attention and notice. Although perhaps, you know, in recent months in the United States, we have really been put on notice about forms of Christian extremism. But one of my purposes of having this radio show is to really break down barriers and to give, you know, helpful information. And I wonder, what are your thoughts about just the misconceptions that so many people have about Muslim Americans?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, you kind of hit it on the head, right? We get stereotyped, generalized, you know what I mean? There's an image of what Muslims are, or who Muslims are, overseas based on, you know, what happens in the news and stuff. And those constitute such a small minority. I mean, there are 1.7, roughly 1.8 billion Muslims on the planet, right? And the number of terrorists in the world, according to official government sources, is not more than 50,000 individuals, right?
Right.
So we get lumped in with those. I mean, if you think about it percentage-wise, it's like 0.0001% of all Muslims in the world. It is an unfair characterization. You know what I mean? And that's kind of like saying, you know, comparing, looking at the KKK and saying, these are representatives of Christianity.
Right.
Yeah. Which is absurd. Every Christian would be like, that's completely false. Right. Even, you know what I mean? So, we do, you know, as a director of outreach, as an imam, one of our jobs is on a daily basis to kind of dispel these notions as much as we can. Right. Sometimes it's through building friendships, you know what I mean? Just being neighborly. Sometimes it's through talks like this. Sometimes it's through, you know, whatever means we can really get a hold of. We try to do open mosques where we invite people into the mosque. We had a gentleman who was, I want to say, in his 50s, and he had gone back to community college just to, you know, resume his studies. Uh-huh. And part of it, he took a class, World Religions, and the professor challenged them, which I salute this, to go to a house of worship for to a religion that they've never been to before. So he went out on a limb and he said, uh-huh. I'm going to go to a mosque. And he said, it took me, even though he's a grown man, he said, it took me a month to muster up the courage to call the mosque and to see if he could come over. And we answered the phone. We told him, yeah, sure, come. And he came over. He didn't know what to expect. He was super apprehensive in the beginning. He didn't know. And he sat down, you know, observed the service, observed the sermon. You know, I sat down with him afterwards, and he was completely floored. And he opened up to me. You know, he was doing an interview for his paper, and he said, you know, my pastor at the church that I go to has told us on multiple occasions that your mosque is a training camp for terrorists. And yet when I came in and I listened to your sermon, I heard nothing but love, nothing but compassion. Everybody was welcoming to me. Yeah. He's like, in fact, I felt more welcome here than I did in my own church. I was like, oh, okay, I don't know about that one, but you know. Yeah. And he said, I don't know which church he goes to. You know what I mean? But unfortunately, there is that message out there of fear-mongering, fear of the other, fear of the unknown that's completely promoted and pushed onto people unjustly. You know what I mean? That the pastor doesn't know what he's even talking about. You know what I mean? Whoever said that. And this is why we try to even reach out to clergy. And there's plenty of excellent clergy in the city of Memphis. I've had nothing personally, you know what I mean? In my encounters, I've had nothing but good. But those are usually because the people who are actually participating in interfaith and outreach and stuff, you know, are usually people that are already open-minded and kind of don't need, you know what I mean, reprogramming, if that's the word. So it's the people that are, you know, isolated or that are, you know what I mean, within their little bubbles, and they don't want to leave, and they don't want to, you know what I mean, encounter people that, you know, just because we think differently or we worship a little different. It shouldn't be threatening. And then on top of this, if you actually look at the core of what it is that we preach, you'll find so many commonalities that you'll be surprised. You know, we did this test so many times where we would go, when we were back in Utah, we would go to like interfaith gatherings, and we'd read a verse from the Quran and a verse from the Bible, and the audience couldn't tell which is which. You know, you can't a lot of times. And what people might assume is this, it's actually the other one, and so on and so forth. So,
When I was living in New Orleans, there were a number of Turkish Muslims there in grad school, and they led a pilgrimage to Turkey. And so I had an opportunity to go and have dinner in the homes of Muslim families when I was there. And just like the gentleman in your example, was treated with the utmost of respect, hospitality. It was just an amazing experience. And one of them gave me a copy of the Quran in English. Now, I have to admit, I have not read the whole thing. And I know that the traditional way is to have it, of course, in Arabic. But to find out that in the Quran, there is, you know, talk about Jesus and Mary and Joseph and so many of the prophets that I would consider in my own faith tradition. They're actually holy people for Muslims as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Oh, yeah. We have about 25 prophets that are named by name in the Quran, but there are many others. The Quran says there are many others that we have not named for you, you know, obviously due to either lack of space or time or whatnot. So when Prophet Muhammad himself was asked, we have a narration. He was asked, how many prophets were there before you? And he said, over 125,000 prophets. 125,000 prophets before me. Because there's a verse in the Quran that says, there's not a town on earth except that God has sent them a prophet at one point in time. Which is why if you look at these universal ideas, you know what I mean, of righteousness and goodness and wellness. And there's ideas of prayer and supplicating and charity. And like you said, even fasting is a universal thing. The Quran actually alludes to this. The verse that commands us to fast says, O you who have believed, Fasting is now prescribed upon you as it was prescribed upon those before you. So this is a direct reference to the people of the mm-hmm. faiths before us, that they also had versions of fasting. And then it says, in order for you to achieve righteousness, you know, God awareness, taqwa. The word in Arabic is used taqwa, which is that righteousness, God awareness, etc. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, and for our listening audience who may not be aware of the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism is the oldest. Christianity is second. And in fact, Jesus was born into a devout Jewish family, lived his whole life as an observant Jewish man, and died as a Jew. And best we understand, never came to create a whole new denomination, but really wanted to call the people of Israel to be more faithful to the teachings of God as he understood them. And then mm-hmm. Islam would be the third of the three Abrahamic. So you all are the most recent of the third.
Yes, yes. And we're also, you know, our spiritual lineage comes from, or at least because Prophet Muhammad is one of the descendants of Ishmael, whereas all the other prophets were the descendants of Isaac, of the children of Abraham.
Of Isaac. And they were both, both sons of Abraham. And of course, Ishmael was the firstborn son of Hagar. And then Isaac was the son of Sarah.
Yes.
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 So now you work with the Memphis Islamic Center. Do you have a sense of how many Muslims we have in this part of the state of Tennessee? Is there a large Muslim population?
I mean, you know, large is always relative, right? You know, compared to like a place like New York City or Chicago, it's very small. Right. But compared to, you know, nearby Arkansas or, you know, somewhere else, it's actually very large. We have, it's estimated that in Memphis, we have about between 20 and 25,000 Muslims, right, in the greater Memphis area.
Got it. Wow.
And this is our estimate based upon different, you know, stats and different numbers that we've observed over the years. But there's no way to know for sure. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is because our mosques, we don't have membership and we don't have individualized congregations. That's not how it works. Like I said, when we have, because we don't really have like hard denominational lines drawn, we do have differences within the Muslim community. We have four different, you know, schools of law. And this just really comes down to how do we practice the religion? These mainly morphed into more geographical preferences. And then when you come to America, because it's a melting pot, you have Muslims from all over the world. So every mosque has really a hodgepodge of all of these different schools of law practiced within the same mosque. And it's not a problem because we all, I mean, we tend to grow up understanding that there are these little subtle practical differences, but theologically, they're pretty much the same. So because of that, we have about eight mosques in Memphis. And all eight mosques really share the same congregation, if that makes sense. So a Muslim will decide to go to a mosque simply based upon geographical proximity, whichever one that I'm closest to. So a lot of Muslims will pray, for example, Friday prayers, because they happen midday. On a weekday, a lot of people will actually be closer to work. So there's a lot of mosques that are closer to downtown or to the airport area that accommodate a lot of the working people. But because a lot of them live out in the suburbs, in the evening, they'll go to a different mosque for the evening prayers because they'll go to the suburban mosque that's closer to where they live. Because of this, Memphis is also, I think, very fortunate that the mosques generally cooperate with one another, but every mosque is actually run by its own separate organization, its own people. They have their own board, etc. And this is one of the ways that Islam is kind of a unique faith in that it's really from the ground up. It's a grassroot level religion. So we don't have central national leadership, religious leadership. We do have conferences where we come together, but we discuss in a very egalitarian form. All the imams come around. We have imams conferences. We discuss what's been working, what hasn't. But we don't have like a leadership up top to tell us kind of what to do or what to say, right? So it's very democratic or very egalitarian in that regards.
There's no Muslim bishop, in other words.
Yeah, no, 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 we don't have for you all. No, no, we don't have a Muslim bishop. No, we have. We just have. We're in fact, you know, even the term imam. A lot of people are surprised. It's not. There's no official definition for what actually makes an imam, right? Really, historically, an imam just means the person who leads the prayers. So whoever leads the imam is the prayer leader. And really, every community, we can nominate just whoever we think. And so Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in a narration that we have for him, he says, let the people be led by the most knowledgeable of the Quran. So the book. And if their knowledge is similar, then the eldest, right? Then it becomes to age. Where historically, Prophet Muhammad, actually, there was a town that came and the entire town became Muslim. And so they said, we want to build a mosque and we want to designate an imam for us. Can you designate somebody for us? And so the Prophet, he interviewed, he said, okay, do you have any memorizers of the Quran? Nobody had the whole thing memorized yet. And then this 12-year-old boy comes along and he says, oh, messenger of God, I have, you know, this big chapter memorized, chapter number 2, Surah Al-Baqarah, right? Huge chapter. It's the largest chapter in the Quran. And he said, I have this chapter memorized and I have this other chapter memorized. And the Prophet immediately said, you'll be the imam. You'll lead them in prayer because you have more Quran memorized and understood than some of the elders. So a 12-year-old boy could be an imam, which happened, you know what I mean? It's a valid opinion.
Yeah. So now this leads me to another question then. Are girls taught the Quran? And could a woman ever be an imam?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So yeah, obviously all of our girls are taught the Quran. You know what I mean? We'd never want to hold them back from knowledge. In fact, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he says, seeking knowledge is an obligation upon every Muslim. Every Muslim, and he didn't make any exceptions. And so we're commanded to really learn and go out. In fact, the first mufti is a person who gives religious answers to religious questions. They have to be qualified in some way, meaning they have to have proper training, they have to have some knowledge. And so a mufti, really, now in modern times, a mufti is an official term that you had gone through rigorous studies, you know, comprehensive knowledge of Islam, etc. But historically, the first mufti was Aisha, the wife of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. This is because she had intimate knowledge of the Prophet's personal life as well as public life that arguably no one else had. And so people, major companions, major men figures, men and women, would go to her for that, for those religious rulings. You know, what is the ruling on if a man does this or a woman does this or if this happens or if that happens? And she was issuing these rulings, right? And this is why arguably she's the first mufti in Islam. There are many other women that were very prominent in these religious roles of giving advice and whatnot. When it comes to the act of leading prayer, a woman can lead the prayer if it's a congregation of women as well. But in mixed congregations, because we believe as Muslims in the appropriateness of gender relations, that things have to be maintained. There's a certain, you know, we call it adab, which is manners, and quorum, etc. That if it's in a mixed congregation, it has to be a man, right? But leading the prayer is not it's not a privilege, right? In fact, Prophet Muhammad was asked about this. He said, if one of you seeks leading the prayer, he said, do not seek leadership. And it could mean general leadership or it could mean actually leading the prayer. And then he said, because it's a responsibility. And then he praised the people who call to prayer. So the person, the mu'adhin, the person who calls to the prayer, he said, that's a better job to have than leading the prayer because it's a responsibility. Meaning there's no added benefit in actually leading the prayer. So it's not a guarantee of paradise. It's not a guarantee of forgiveness. It's not a badge of righteousness either. So just because I'm an imam, I lead the prayer, does not make me inherently better than anyone else in the congregation, right? In fact, I could be the imam, and then I could be one of the worst people there in the eyes of God, because it does not speak to anything about my place in terms of, you know, who I am. And this is why Prophet Muhammad, he has a lot of teachings that actually say, perhaps there is a man who gets pushed at the doorways, who is unknown to the public, who, if he asks people of anything, they will not give him. But if he asks God, God will give him everything, because he is greater in the eyes of God, that entire congregation, meaning this unknown person, because of who he is and how righteous he is. And then he says, perhaps there's a person who's well known, he's famous, he's wealthy, etc. Everybody respects him, everybody listens to him, but in the eyes of God, he's the worst, you know what I mean, on earth, right? In another narration, there were two people who walked by. One was very poor, almost unknown, barely anybody knew his name. And another person walked by, he was wealthy, popular, famous. And the Prophet asked his companions, what do you say about this man, the poor person? They said, nobody knows him. I mean, if he were to try to get married, nobody would give them their daughter. If he tried to intercede and help people, nobody would accept his word. And, you know, nobody would seek his advice. Nobody knows who he is. But the other person, the wealthy person, well-known, popular, famous, etc. And the Prophet said, that one man, the poor man, is better than an earthful of that wealthier man. And it's not due to his wealth, right? It has nothing to do with his wealth, and it has nothing to do with his poverty. It has everything to do with their inherent relationship with God and not their relationship with people. So just because I have a title in front of my name, this is what I was trying to say. Just because we have a title in front of our name doesn't really mean anything in the eyes of God, right? So this is a central Islamic tenet.
Yeah. Yes. So what I hear you saying is that men and women are equal in God's sight, because it's not just people with titles. They're not higher in the quote unquote hierarchy than those who don't have them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly right.
There are sects of Christianity and of Judaism where women cannot lead when it is a mixed congregation of men and women, that if it's just a group of women, they can lead the Bible study or the prayer or whatever. But once men enter the equation, because of their understanding, like you said, of the gender roles, a man is the one who leads. So that is not unique to Islam.
Right, right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's a history there. Yeah, for sure.
A couple of things before we conclude. One is, if someone would be curious about learning more about the Islamic Center and your programs and activities, how could they find out more about what the Muslim community here in Memphis is doing?
Yeah. So we have, you know, our website, of course, the memphisislamiccenter.org. It's without the, so it's just memphisislamiccenter.org. We also have, I believe, we have a YouTube channel. I believe we have the largest YouTube channel out of any religious congregation in Memphis. I could be mistaken, but according to my research, yeah. So we have a big online audience, which we're very grateful for. Our YouTube channel, we have over like 123,000 subscribers to our YouTube channel, and we get hundreds and thousands of views on our videos. You know what I mean, on a regular basis, sermons that we put up. So we try to live stream everything. And this was before COVID. So when COVID hit, we were actually very fortunate and very prepared to, you know, to take things online. And so people can follow us really there. If you subscribe to our YouTube channel, all of our programs are public. You know, like we said, we have nothing to hide. You know, we want people to know what's going on inside of our mosque. I believe a lot of the things, like you said, there's a lot of these universal values, right? There's a lot of these universal messages that I think would be beneficial for anybody, regardless of their faith tradition. We're fortunate enough that at the Memphis Islamic Center, we just opened up our new building. And the current phase is like a 53,000 square foot building where we can accommodate, in normal times, we can accommodate over 3,000 worshipers. Right now in COVID, with social distancing, every night we have about 400 people that are coming every night for the nightly services during the month of Ramadan. We live stream that on a nightly basis. You know, we're fortunate enough that we have, you know, a lot of these you know, different programs that are going on. We have multiple imams, myself. We have Imam Muhammad Faqih, is very good. We have Imam Yasser Fazaga, who is not only an imam, but he's also a licensed therapist, and specifically a family therapist. And so he does a lot of our counseling, you know, mental health issues. And he's been a great asset as well. And so before Ramadan started, he had a weekly show, in which he would highlight, you know, his show is called Let's Talk About It. And sometimes it would be taboo topics that people are uncomfortable talking about, but he would talk about them to bring them out into the light and discuss, whether it's about, you know, drug addiction, whether it's about, you know, divorce rates, whether it's about, you know, even he's a certified sexologist. So even he would even bring up, you know, stuff like that, that maybe is not appropriate for younger audience, but it's very helpful for married couples. So he goes into a lot of detail, which we're very fortunate to have. So
sounds like there are lots of ways for people to learn more about the Muslim community here in Shelby County. Yeah. And the final question that I normally have for my guests, and I think it's, you know, especially true for you as a Muslim American, you know, there's so many negative things in this world today, impacting us generally, and then I would imagine just specifically for the Muslim community. So what is it that gives you joy? Like, how are you avoiding despair or hopelessness, even though things are very challenging right now?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question. You know, I think it's a number of things, right? It's number one, our faith in God, that we put our trust in Him, right? It would be very easy if the only thing that's required is to just say, yeah, I trust God, but then not embody it in action, or I believe in God, or I, you know, by having to actually live it and go through it, is where the test actually lies. And this is how we actually grow as individuals, is by, you know what I mean, following up in actions what we claim to believe inside. And really, in our actions is where we prove our faith, right? A person can even say this about, you know, we have some Muslims that might make that claim where, you know, they say, oh yeah, I'm good. I don't need to pray five times a day. God knows that I love Him. Okay, sure. God knows everything. But love is not just a feeling. Love is not just a claim, right? We have to back it up in actions. That's like a husband saying to his wife, yeah, my wife knows that I love her. Okay, when was the last time you did something nice for her? When was the last time you took her out or bought her flowers or told her something nice? You know what I mean? Oh, it's been ages. So then how, you know, if you asked her, do you think your husband loves you? She might say, I don't think so anymore. You know, he hasn't been showing it in his actions. So we have to kind of show it in our actions, right? We have to back it up, what our claim is. So that you know, faith in action, you know, is definitely there. I think programs like this, people like you, Phoebe, give me hope that we have people that are reaching out, you know, that are you know, trying to facilitate more understanding, you know what I mean? More genuine conversation, more, you know, outreach out there in the world, right? We don't, we think that we can live in these isolated bubbles, but that's not reality. You know what I mean? It might've been the case historically for almost the entire world, right? The average human being never traveled beyond 25 miles of where they were born historically, but now we can get anywhere in the world, right? America is a country of immigrants and of different faiths and people. I mean, Muslims have been in America since its inception, whether people realize that or not. You know, oh yeah. We have, you know, historical records of Muslims being here. It's estimated that even among African-American slaves that were brought, between 30 and 50% of them were actually Muslim, right? And they got their faith completely taken away from them. Many tried to maintain it. Many were actually learned. They knew how to read and write. They were actually scholars. You know, as is well known, there's a number of documented cases. But we also had immigrants that came on their own from Albania, from Turkey, from Syria in the 1800s and established places. You know, one of the oldest mosques in the Western world is in South Dakota. And there's another one in Iowa, in the middle of nowhere. Nobody would ever believe, you know what I mean? Thinking like, really? And it's still there. And it's because we had early families migrate to that area, you know what I mean, became farmers and lived there. So Islam actually has a very rich history in this country, but it came to the spotlight only recently. And so now, you know what I mean, it's our job to kind of show people, hey, we've been here actually for a very long time. You might not have known us, but you know, we're actually here. I think there's a lot of things that can give us hope. I'm naturally an optimist. I'm not a you know what I mean? I'm not a skeptic necessarily. Although there are many things that are worrying and concerning, you know, that are going on in our country and abroad. But I'm hopeful that reason is winning out. Love will always win out. If we look historically, yes, we've always had dark moments in history. But I think if we look, the light has always, always shone brighter and better than the dark, always. And this is, I think this is a human trait. So that gives me hope.
Wow. Well, thank you, Anwar, not only for this conversation, but for being a wonderful colleague in the ministry field here in Memphis. And
thank you.
Blessings on you and your Muslim community during the remainder of the season of Ramadan.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. You know, it's always a pleasure, and you know, I enjoy our conversations as always, Phoebe. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Anwar for a wonderful conversation. I know I learned a lot about the Muslim community here in Memphis. So until next week, sisters and brothers, stay strong and stay positive.